Before I move on in this chapter in Romans, I want to speak again a little bit, or perhaps mostly the clarification of issues I've talked about. It's always risky to talk about contemporary issues. When I'm speaking of contemporary matters, which involve the economic and political and foreign and so forth, I want it clearly understood I'm speculating and not speaking to you with particular authority. I think I speak out of a degree of knowledge, but I don't mean to be authoritative in the sense of saying this is it. You know, those are areas where anyone could disagree and be quite welcome to do so. But it is risky to get off into those areas because there are so many different angles to consider. One thing that I've talked about relative to the future of the United States, which I have to say is speculative totally, and should be more noted as such by the prophets today. They ought to quit talking about getting this as a revelation from God and just say it's, you know, what they conceive to be their interpretation of the Bible, which they're welcome to, you know, but it's the authoritative way in which they go about these pronouncements that troubles me. Anyone that would conclude his discussion by saying, well, this is speculation on my part, would have my vote, even if he didn't have my concurrence always in what he was saying. So I've engaged in some of these speculations, and I really want to make it clear to you that I have said there is no direct reference in the Bible to the United States. There are passages people take symbolically, but there's no way we can nail that down and say this is the United States. So the point I'm really making is, inasmuch as there are no direct references to the United States in the Bible, we cannot include it in the prophetic statements with anything of authority. We can only be speculative about it. My own conclusions have been that given the nature of world history, given the nature of the makeup of the American society today, given the attitude of America in general as an attitude of benevolence toward the world, given America's relationship to Israel, given America's high percentage of people involved in one way or another with the church or with religious affiliation or with sensitivity or sympathy with God and so forth. Given all those aspects, I am saying that they do not appear to me to be in such a position as to require the kind of divine fury that people are pronouncing upon it. Okay? And I've talked about our national sins as more or less sandbox stuff as compared to the activities going on in the Middle East, for example, in the Muslim world, in the Iran, and the things that have happened over there have been of such vehemence against Israel that there is some reason to think God might come down upon them in judgment, where the PLO, for example, which is not a state, only an association, rapidly achieving status in the international arena, but the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, who seemed to be the key point in the settling of the Middle Eastern crisis, that is, they seem to be key in the continuing of the peace agreements with Israel and Egypt. But people like the PLO have vowed to drive Israel into the sea. I mean, have denied the right of Israel to exist. Those are the kind of people that might justifiably be the object of God's wrath, but not America, whose greatest crimes have to do with sandbox stuff, you see. And, of course, somebody is shocked to think that I would think of the terrible things going on in Las Vegas as sandbox stuff. But after all, they're all children up there playing around, not playing nicely. Yeah, some of the games are a little naughty, but they're not the world's most heinous crimes, and they make their own hell anyway. They got enough hell in Las Vegas to last them an eternity. If you were to delve into the private lives of the show people up there and the gambling people and so forth, you'd find a pretty hellish world for them, and they don't need any extra hell on top of it. Yet again, I think you would find, this is just pure raw speculation, but knowing human nature quite a bit and having dealt with what we might call, in quotes, the raunchier element of society, with apologies to Las Vegas, I don't mean that everybody, I'm sure there's a very, very large segment of Las Vegas that is a perfectly normal city, but I'm talking really about the Las Vegas of symbol, you know, the show gambling world there. But I have dealt deeply with a lot of people in the in that echelon or that segment of life, and you'd be amazed at how much faith you find in those people. That is, how much openness to the idea of God, how much they need God and depend on Him often. They're not rabidly anti-God people. They're people caught up in a life process, often unwittingly. That is, the showgirls get drawn in, you know, going maybe with stars in their eyes to become waitresses or to get a bit of the glamour of Las Vegas. And they shouldn't do this, but they don't go there with the idea of being evil persons. You know, they go with perfectly normal ambitions and so forth, and they get caught up in it. They get drawn in, and the gambling people and so forth. Now, there are a lot of people that have gone to Las Vegas to kind of drop out. I remember a minister who got into a lot of trouble in his church, and he went to Las Vegas, became a shill in one of the casinos there, in the gambling operation, paying his piper, as a lot of the show people are up there. So you look upon these people not as the nation's great symbol of sin upon which God is going to pour out His wrath. You look upon them as wretched souls caught in a trap from which most of them are unable to extricate themselves. And your heart goes out to them. My heart goes out to these people, especially since the pleasures they sought there have been very, very short-lived, even if they are all that are anticipated. If one goes there and makes it all right and gets into whatever they want to get into, and the anticipation of how glorious and adventurous and glamorous a life is going to be, even that at its best becomes readily divested of all of its glamour, and it becomes a tragic saga of life for them all. So I don't look upon the Las Vegas people and rant and rave against carnality. I look at them and weep for their wretchedness. And yet you go across America and you find pockets of great carnality or evil or whatever you want to call it. And these are aberrations of society from which the world has never been free. Even Israel is not free of those things. Wretched things happen in Israel, as you read the Bible, in their conduct. But that was not the thing God judged Israel for. He didn't judge them for their transgressions. He judged them primarily for their idolatry. The nation of America is not a fit object of divine wrath in spite of its carnal conduct. That is not to say all of America is saved, or not to say that the people that are in transgression are not displeasing to Christ. It's not to say any of those things at all. It's not to say we are not materialistic, and yet in this country, and perhaps in this world, you can hardly live without being materialistic. You're just, you know, just keeping body and soul together is a gargantuan task, especially when you think that even if you put a savings account together, your interest keeps well behind the inflationary rise. Anyway, it's a losing game, so you just have to fight to survive, to meet your bills every month, and especially if you're in a more or less moderate middle-class bracket where the pinch is probably worse than anything because there's so many things that the middle-class person has settled into with fixed incomes that are being rapidly priced out of their reach and so forth. So it's a difficult situation at best, and to be materialistic in our sense, I would look at every person of you here in this room and say to myself, you do not fit the category of materialistic. You're not saying I'm going to have my material goods at any cost, or whoever I hurt, or whether I neglect Christ or not. And I'm generalizing, but for anyone to point the finger at any one of you in this room and say that you are materialistic and God is unhappy with our materialism would be a gross injustice. Now, you could point to some of the people that are grappling and striving for the top and say they were perhaps materialistic. Yes, but I'm talking about the John Q. public, the average person, especially when someone points to the church as being materialistic, the body of believers as a whole. There are some that are materialistic, but not as a whole. They're just really trying to keep ahead of the wolf. And that is true of people who, let us say, have had to work late and miss a meeting somewhere. You know, that's not materialism to put Christ, to put their work ahead of Christ. It may be just a necessity to keep going. And that's, I never criticize people for not coming to meetings. You know that. You're all just as welcome. If you miss 10 weeks and come the 11th, you're just as welcome as you can be. And I'm just glad to see you. And I'm not judging anybody. You know what you can stand or what you can handle or what you can get away with. And I don't know that. Even if you stayed away because you got a little tired of it, I would understand that perfectly. I wouldn't be judgmental about that. Again, in this whole matter of judging others, it's so idiotic for one person to say to another person, you're being materialistic or carnal or you shouldn't do this or you shouldn't do that. We're just human beings trying to make it in the world. For every fault your neighbor has, you have at least one, you know, maybe two. So it's dumb for one Christian to judge another Christian. And Paul, this is the burden of Paul's message here. He says in chapter 14 of Romans, do you have faith? Have it to yourself before God. You know, that's the whole burden of the chapter. Don't judge other people. You believe you ought to do something and do it and keep your mouth shut. And that's probably one of the biggest curses of the church is judgmental attitudes. Well, now when someone comes along in great with their prophetic intonations, you know, that the America is just so terrible and everybody's doing all these terrible things, obviously what they're doing is standing up on a pedestal and saying, I don't do those things, and I'm better than you are. I was just reading a magazine not too long ago about a certain active evangelist, quite promotional-minded, and it was a documented article of one of his close associates who was just involved in one scandalous scam after another, bilking people, getting through his connection with this fellow, getting in places, and I think the ultimate tally was about $9 million that he had swindled people out of using the name of the organization he was a board member of. It's just hard to think that those people are so naive that they'd let him be on their board for years conducting those swindles. But the point is, here's someone who is out really beating the woods and getting on the stumps for the moral turpitude of America. It just doesn't make any sense at all. All of that to the point of saying that my evaluation of America's position before God is based not upon a biblical statement or a revelation from above, but upon an assessment of the conditions of America and of the world as a somewhat sociologist and anthropologist and psychologist and so forth, as having made a considerable training in the fields of behavioral science and so forth, and just assessing mankind and America and so forth, and then from a theological point of view, from a Christian point of view, what God requires of us, what God is interested in. And I have some expertise in the field of the Bible, where I take from the pages the idea that God is gracious, and that His greatest interest is in our identification with Him, and not so much in whether we're all perfect or not. In other words, to stay true to God would have kept Israel out of the soup, even if they were conducting themselves sometimes indiscreetly, had they stayed true to God. Now, this nation so far has stayed true to God as a nation. Now, people say, well, look, they're getting prayer out of the classroom. And I have a standard answer for that. Would you like a Buddhist or a Hindu or a cultist of some kind to be presenting their religious view in the classroom to your child? Well, you have to look at it. If you say the classroom ought to be open to religious instruction or to prayers, you have to say that whoever is in charge of that classroom, whatever teacher is there, is going to have to be the leader of that prayer. And I say leave it to the parents at home to handle that part, because you can't trust who you're going to have in the classroom, see? So I think it's, I would vote easily to put prayer out of the classroom. That isn't irreligious, that's just common sense. Of course, when people want prayer in the classroom, they always want the Christian prayer. Well, of course, this nation can't constitutionally demand that everybody has to function on the Christian level. It seems so religiously sweet to say, well, we ought to have prayer in our classroom, and America's godless because it takes prayer out of the classroom. If pastors don't like what's going on in schools of the public, they ought to start their own schools. But that takes a little initiative, and they don't do it. But we did that. I didn't like what was going on. I didn't feel the classroom ought to have prayer in it, so we started our own classrooms. Of course, the position of the church originally, they taught the schools were church schools from the very beginning in America. It was when the American families gave up that privilege of teaching their children and asked the state to do it that we got into trouble. That's where the problem was, not that we didn't allow prayer in the classroom, but that we turned the classroom over to the government in the first place because we wanted government subsidies for it. There's a number of very large Christian schools in this country, colleges and universities, that are so under obligation to the government now that the government can walk in and change the whole Board of Regents if they want to. That's in the contract. Whenever you borrow money from the government has a right to come in and change the Board of Regents if they don't think you're running your school properly. So over and over again, the church has gotten themselves into the soup in these matters and they haven't functioned wisely in terms of the constitutionality of our country. And what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If we expect the Constitution to be upheld in other areas, we've got to uphold it in these areas of free speech too, you see. An atheist has a right to speak in America. That's part of his guaranteed constitutional right, as much as the Christian has a right to speak. We have no right to force Christian principles upon the atheist. But that does not mean this country's godless. I'm trying to bring a little sanity into that picture. God can do what he wants to with the Middle East, and maybe whatever they're doing they deserve, but I'm out of that arena. I've got to assess not the Middle East, but the United States. And I've traveled widely in it and spoken in churches from Vancouver to Gaspé and from Gaspé to Miami and crisscross back and forth. I've spoken in churches all over America. And I've followed the Christian population, and I've followed the public school population, having taught there for many, many years. So, I've been around, and I assess the nation's position as being what I've described to you. Now, I've said all of that also to make the following point. If I do not believe that America is going to be the object of God's great wrath, by the same token, I have not said and will not say that America would not go through some economic distress. I'm not saying that God is going to preserve America from trouble. I wouldn't even guarantee to you that we wouldn't get into a Third World War or a war with Russia. I wouldn't guarantee that. But whatever happens is not what is being talked about in Ezekiel 38, which people call Armageddon. That's a different subject. I don't believe, and this is purely speculative, and it's based upon history, it's based upon the following of political science, and a rather deep study of these things. In fact, I had just recently last Saturday a couple of hours with a very close friend of mine who is a political scientist. He's just written a 900-page book on Yugoslavia, the political conditions of Yugoslavia and so forth, which I reviewed for him and edited and worked with him on. This fellow and I have talked 4 or 5 hours at a stretch. We have read books together and discussed these books, come together every week, political, social, historical situation in America, and talked about it, discussed it. Anyway, for years we've done that. Now, I've been talking with others of similar stature, and so we glean a lot of things about the world. This fellow was born in Yugoslavia, incidentally, knows the communist situation well, and has written his book, Contra Communism. That is, he's written about the Yugoslav experiment in communism, which he shows the fallacies of, you know. Anyway, so it's not just out of the blue that I say things, but these things are, nevertheless, speculatively and based upon numbers of sources of information, it has been my contention that probably Russia is not in a position to go to war against America, and probably won't be. That's based upon not biblical revelations or private visions, but upon a study of the political, social, historical scene. Given the position, which is very close to parity, that is equal, of U.S. and Russian arms, military defenses, Russia's not that overwhelmingly ahead of us that they could afford to just gamble on attacking us. You see, it wouldn't be like attacking Afghanistan, for example, you see, which might be worth the gamble to them, although it's proved to be a very troublesome experiment on their part. But I want to give you some peace of mind to say that Russia is not in a position at the present time, nor really in the foreseeable future, of making a mass attack upon America. But I'm going to add this point, that in spite of what I may regard as military parity, it is doubtful to me that America could preserve itself apart from God's help. In other words, I think our security here is not going to be based upon our own military capacity, but upon the grace of God, as it was in World War II. By all odds, we should have lost that war. Given A, the attack on Pearl Harbor, which was so devastating to our forces, and B, the numbers of mistakes that were made in our military operation, just ghastly mistakes that never really have come out in the public view, given certain other factors, as for example the great efficiency of the German Wehrmacht, the war machine, and the Japanese imperial forces, given the great efficiency and dedication, see, because whereas we look upon Hitler now as the scourge of the earth, his people apparently were, under some mass hypnotism, they were so impressed with him that they really followed him by the millions fanatically. I don't think they had the slightest idea of what was really going on, many of them, but incidentally, you must understand that the German people had been beat down mercilessly after World War I. The seeds of World War II were in the Treaty of Versailles, because the military, the German people had been so totally humiliated and wiped out that finally the burden became so great to bear that they had reparations to make as a result of the Versailles Treaty, had reparations to make they couldn't afford to make because of, while they had all these reparations to make, a repayment to the peoples that were of the war area, they were also not permitted heavy industry so that they could make enough money to pay them. You know, they were having to borrow money to make their reparations payments, and they were not allowed any kind of military force. There were just so many provisions of Versailles that beat the German people down that it was really small wonder that when a man like Hitler rose up before them with some force and tore the treaty apart, tore it in half and threw it away and said, we're going to ignore this because all it's done is just destroyed Germany, and they fell in behind him, understandably. Maybe not rightly, but understandably. And he lifted the nation out of the doldrums, got them back on their footing. But like Napoleon of old, see, Napoleon Bonaparte was a superb ruler. Now, many of you may be saying, well, what has this got to do with the Bible? And it has more than you may realize. His power with the people was shown by the fact that 10 years after the blood ran in the streets of Paris, getting rid of a king, they, by plebiscite, which means popular vote, made Napoleon emperor. And he established an educational system for France. He established the Banque de France, financial stability for France, and just did many, many things. And what got Napoleon into trouble were his excursions out, you know, his national adventures, war adventures. That's what really... If he'd just stuck with building France, he'd have gone down in history as one of the noblest emperors in the world. Now, given all these things, the Axis powers should have won the war. In the Battle of Britain, when Germany was mercilessly bombarding the poor little British Isles, in the middle of the very fiercest of bombing raids, Hermann Göring, I think that was the one, who was head of the German Luftwaffe, just suddenly decided not to continue bombing Britain. And they turned and went eastward, you see, instead. Went into Russia. And that was their great mistake, because they got into... The Russians did the same thing with him they did with, I mean, with the Germans that they did with Napoleon. And that they did with King Charles of Sweden, Charles X, I think, of Sweden, in the time of Peter the Great. What they did was to let the German machine roll on into Russia. It was in the winter. And let them roll up to Stalingrad, where they were too deeply embedded in the country to ever get out again. And it was a fierce winter, and the Russians were just in their element fighting there in the winter. That stopped the German war machine. The point I want to make, I'm speaking to you thus not out of having read a paperback sometime or a magazine article. When I say to you that throughout the history of America, the only thing that has saved it again and again has been the grace of God. Over and over again, America has come within a whisker of being destroyed. Given all the facts of history and of the present time, it is doubtful to me that America can be preserved apart from the power of God. But after all, he's preserved that little dot on the map, Israel, through all of these centuries with the world breathing down its neck. And here's this little pinpoint, so small you can hardly see it on the map, surrounded by the whole of the Middle East and 750 million Muslims, and it has remained afloat. All right, now out of all of this, I want to say then that America's hope is really in God, not because America is good enough per se, but because they are God's per se. Just like with Israel. Israel was spared in the past, not because they were any good, but because they were his. Then when they left God and went to idols, the story changed. Now, when Americans pursue gold, that does not mean they are pursuing idols like Israel did. That would be a trivializing of Israel's sin. People say, oh, well, gold is our idol. But that has nothing to do with a pagan god, gods that Israel espoused and left the true God. And they were adulterers. Israel was called an adulteress. That's why I think Israel is probably the adulteress in Revelation 17, the whore of Babylon. So then I'm saying that America's hope lies in retaining its allegiance to God, not so much in moral majority revivals, which may find the crimes on both sides of the fence. It's not moral revival in America. It is retaining our allegiance to God, and therefore B, our allegiance to Israel, our support of Israel. We've got to retain that three-cornered thing. Egypt, Israel, America has got to be retained. I have to include Egypt. That's another story, too. Now, that is speculative to a large degree, but based upon the fact that Israel is going to be is God's object here, and that the Bible especially promises help to those who help Israel, and say blessing on those who are a friend of God's people. We shouldn't abandon that. Now, I do not want you to go out and say that I think that America is not going to have an economic recession or that there's not going to be a war, absolutely, and that I prophesied that. No, don't say those things. I've only said America is not in the picture in the Scripture, and I've said that speculatively I see no reason for God to pour out all this wrath on America, and I've said that Russia's war with the world does not appear in the Bible. There's no military reason to believe Russia's ready to fight us. They are not economically ready to fight us. They are not psychologically ready to fight us. They are not geopolitically ready to fight us. And they are not pictured in the Bible as ready to fight us. Furthermore, as far as the economic fortunes of the United States are concerned, I will make this statement. Number one, I do not see the economic misfortunes of America as ever having really been judgments of God. you can go back to many recessions and depressions in American history that made no alteration in the American stance one way or the other. Just like during the Depression, for example, we went through a very severe depression in the 20s and 30s, as you know, and it was rougher than we have it now, and I suppose more people might have gone to church then, but it didn't stick with us as having been a judgment of God. If God puts a judgment on us, and no one really sees it as a judgment, it has no impact anyway. No one has yet said that the Depression, I mean in any significant number or impact, have ever said that the Depression was a judgment from God upon America, because in fact we came out of the Depression and things were even stronger than they were before. And things were done during the Depression which have preserved our economic structure to this day. The SEC, for example, whereas a lot of these alphabet societies that Franklin Roosevelt established and Hoover began, things like the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, have preserved the economics of America in many, many ways and kept carelessness out of the financial institutions which had erected in the beginning. So there were a lot of things that came out of the Depression that were wholesome for the economic development of America, but no one has looked upon that as having been the great scourge of God, you say. It was just a part of our economic carelessness, perhaps. So many things that were carelessnesses of our economic system. We've done many careless things today, and we may be facing a very similar depression. The problem is that the measures you have to take to curb inflation are also the measures that promote depression. On the other hand, America is not anywhere near total collapse. So don't store your goodies in caves and run for the hills with your gold bullion and sit tight there. Don't do that, because that's just one of those things that we've weathered worse storms than this in America, and we'll weather them yet. So just be stable and sensible. I want you to be sensible about all these things and moderate, and don't go running off onto all of these visionary tangents. Well, I took up the time. Yeah, this is not irrelevant, what I've said tonight, at all. It may not be something that will cause you to sing joyful choruses and click your heels over, but it's something that might help you to survive and be at peace. That's what I want, peace in your hearts, and not peace that is false. I want a true peace that is there, and I want sanity and sensibility there. Well, let's pray. Father, we ask you to take these things that we've talked about tonight and help us to see life in its right perspective and to keep our eyes focused upon you, of course, and to remain simple and trusting in you and open to your guidance. In Christ's name, amen.